In memory of Baby M, Baby M's mother, Jess, is a listener and patron of Time to Talk TFMR.
This podcast is supported by ARC, Antenatal Results and Choices. ARC is the only UK nationwide charity offering non-directive, individualised information and support to parents who are making decisions around antenatal screening and diagnostic testing. They also provide specialised bereavement care for those who experience termination for medical reasons. For more information or support, please call ARC on 0207 713 7486.
The way I feel about Forrest is described by every expression of my being and has been since he became a part of it. My blood is infused with him. The experience of delivering him plays on repeat in my head, and my head is still reeling from it. Illusions dissolve in it. The pain across my shoulders is pressing from it. The words from my lips and fingertips give testimony to the journey we went on together. My baby and I. My baby who died. Forrest was joyful, peaceful and wise. I see him still in my husband's eyes. I feel him still. It's his stillness around me, the cushion between the rest of the world and I. I'm much lonelier than ever, so we sit down together in the forest by the tree, where my grief is free to overflow. I can see him and he can see me, and as we study each other, enjoying the seeing, I understand that Forrest is my reason for being.
Hello and welcome to Time to Talk TFMR, Termination for Medical Reasons. I'm Hayley, and that was Buff reading one of her poems for us about her son, Forrest. What a great way to start the episode and get straight into the emotion of termination. Buff lives in Portugal with her husband, Rasmus, and they run an eco-retreat together there. So welcome, Buff. Thank you so much for reading to us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be able to share my poetry on this platform.
Yeah. I mean, have you always been a writer? Have you always been a poet?
I think poetry's only really been in quite recent years. I don't know. I've always been a writer, though. Stories. When I was a child. And then it's really come back in, the last 5 years or so, I guess. My creativity came back a lot after years and years of office work and burnout and a bit of sort of detachment from self. And then, after we had our TFMR with Forrest, this wasn't very intentional, this poetry. This just came out. It was very organic and
it's very raw. I remember reading it first on social media and going, oh, that is just getting right to the heart of the matter.
I think I needed it helped me, obviously helped me channel the emotions I was feeling. And I remember several times as I wrote the words, actually a lot of them are written through notes, not even handwritten. Notes on my phone. And as I'm typing, just huge waves of tears and outpourings. And it was just, the right words were like keys, like little keys unlocking these pieces of grief and trauma. And but it wasn't like, okay, I need to deal with these emotions, so I'm going to focus on my poetry. It really wasn't thought through. It just happened.
Yeah, it's in a sort of outpouring. You can tell, though, you can tell when you read it and hearing you speak it, that is its root, that is its way, that this just came flowing out.
Yeah. And it happened before I was pregnant, a couple of years before that, just dealing with grief around climate change and stuff like this, work in environmental activism, and I was working on a few different projects. One was with some poets, actually. And around that time, I was involved in more workshops, things like this. And again, just this sort of unlocking of creativity. But I would go to walk out in the countryside here. And if I didn't have my phone with me, poems would come into my head and I'd just end up saying them out loud and I'd not have anything to take them down with. I tried to repeat the lines to try and commit them to memory and eventually I'd get lost and I had to give it up to nature because I guess that was the point. But it helped with a lot of those big feelings, the overwhelm and trying to hold all of that uncertainty. And
Yeah, I'm really curious around that, you know, when using creative methods to work through grief, you know, it's been labeled as creative self-care before, you know, how that process, because grief, and I think, you know, the process of TFMR in particular, it just takes us to that place of darkness. It's just so visceral. And how creativity can, like you say, be keys, you know, unlock. Yeah, how that works for you, or yeah, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think as well, it's kind of offers you a safe container to pour that darkness into. You can't hurt anyone with a poem or a piece of art, or but yeah. It's a transference of energy. So instead of it swirling in your mind or, you know, staying stuck in your body, it's coming out. And I mean, it will always be coming out because
yeah,
you're always generating new feelings around these experiences. But I think the reason as well it was so supportive is that, so when we had our TFMR, it was springtime, and my usual comfort, you know, escape, my place to go and feel safe, didn't feel so safe. So I had a real weird moment with nature. And it's curious because it's kind of my, you know, my rap sheet is how nature is so healing, and you can go to nature and you can let everything out and da da da. And I felt betrayed by nature. I was angry that everything was coming back to life and he wouldn't. And
yeah,
I really struggled with that for a short, not for too long, but for a short while, like immediately after. And so, in yeah, given that, I think that the poetry, and I draw as well and stuff, and that really gave me, yeah, the safe space to be with those feelings. And for time, like, as it happens, before, I'd been kind of practicing different methods of self-care, and I'd had a few sessions with random people and gathering tools and stuff, and I'd actually had a mentor for a short while who had had a TFMR a couple of years before. And so working with her course and the stuff we worked through together, a lot of it was inspired from what she learned from recovering from the trauma and grief of her experience. So somehow I got lined up with this person. So then when it happened to me, I already had like this little box of tools.
Oh, I see. So you met her before you...
I met her years ago, like 7 years ago. We'd worked together in an environmental organization and we'd maintained a friendship for a long time. And then she developed this practice and this offering, and I worked with her. So yeah, you know, curious, all these things.
Yeah, the universe. Yeah. But what I was hearing in there is that you sort of felt like nature was pouring vinegar on the wound, throwing it in your face. Here is all this regeneration and this coming back to life, and your baby boy died.
Yeah. And he won't come back.
And won't come back. Yeah.
And I found that with my heightened sensitivity, like because of pregnancy, because of all the hormones postpartum, I was incredibly sensitive, and I even found nature a bit overwhelming. The sounds, like sometimes I would wear my Bose headphones to walk outside because it was just too, I was hearing everything so intensely.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a really strange experience for me because I'm such a nature geek and I'm always outside.
Yeah.
And it's my therapy usually. So it was a strange time, but yeah, that's where creativity, I think, kept me afloat. And all the practice I'd had before had taught me to be a little bit less afraid of those darker feelings. Like I'd gotten more familiar with, through cyclical awareness, stuff like that. You know, I'd been tracking my cycle and just being more aware and paying more attention to the way I feel throughout the month and trying to process emotions in a more somatic way, a more bodily way. And so I'd gotten yeah, less resistance to feeling a bit paranoid or a bit manic or a bit depressed, because these are all part of our emotional spectrum. And they happen. They do happen. There's no, like, and the more we push it away, deny it or repress it, the more severely it can kind of build up.
Yeah.
So writing, sometimes writing is just a way to acknowledge those feelings. They get felt, they get like a nod, and that way
they can be released in some way or them. Acknowledged. Yeah. Yeah. So I wonder if you'd like to just talk to us a little bit about, you know, when you found out that there was something wrong with Forrest. What happened for you?
It was our 21-week anomaly scan, or anatomy scan. They call it different things in different places, but yeah, the 21-week scan. And so this was, yeah, last year. There were still regulations in place, so I was alone. I was really, really excited to see her. I was absolutely convinced that it was her. And I'd tried to resist that. It was because everyone around me kept saying the same thing. And I was like, well, we don't know. And in the end, I was thinking it. And I told the sonographer when I went in that I thought it was a girl. And the first thing she said, she told me it was a boy straight away. E menino, she said in Portuguese. And she said, and I was recording at the time, so I have these on video. And she said, everything is perfect till now, okay?
Everything is perfect until now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
She showed me his parts and I giggled. And then she saw his hand, and his hand was making a gesture, like a rock gesture.
Yeah.
And we both laughed at this, and I told her that his father's a drummer. So this was amazing. Like, I thought this was great. And then she went quiet and I drifted off in my head because, you know, I'm having a big recalibration here. I thought I was imagining a girl. So I was just like having all these visions of a boy. And yeah. And then, do you know what? I really didn't sink in. There were so many signs that something was wrong, and I just didn't. It didn't touch me. I was so happy and so sure everything was okay. I don't know.
Somebody kept coming. Did you know that this was an anatomy scan, that there could possibly be something wrong? Or were you sort of going to find out if this is a boy or girl?
Yeah, I was pretty naive I was definitely someone who, after the 12 weeks, all clear, thought that we were fine.
Yeah.
I know that's common. Yeah.
No, but the reason I asked that is because it's sort of like, well, why would you think anything else? Why would you necessarily pick up on the signs at the time if you're not necessarily in that headspace?
I was really cocooned in optimism and so the scan took a long time, and they kept, one girl kept coming in and out. Then the head of obstetrics came in, and they told me this was the head of obstetrics, and I still didn't really think anything. I was like, okay. Then she told me that he wouldn't move his legs. He wouldn't bend his legs. And I started to stroke my belly, and I just thought, oh, he's being weird. he's anxious. So I was trying to like connect to him psychically. Yeah. Like, hey, it's all right. Because also they can be kind of rough when they do these scans, you know.
They press hard, especially when they're trying to look for something, they can push really hard.
And she was trying to get him to move, so she was shoving him, wiggling the wand, and so I thought, god, he's getting stressed out. And I just kept stroking my belly, anyway, eventually they wrapped it up and I went to pee, and when I came back, the head of obstetrics was still there. And they, like, we all sat down, and then they told me that things weren't quite right. And as the conversation wore on, I started to grasp what was happening. And I think it was when they said, you need to think about this because there's not a lot of time, because some people decide to interrupt the pregnancy, and you need to do that before 24 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that was when I realized, like, okay, they mean life. Like life altering problems. And again, I was alone. The one doctor spoke English, one didn't so well, so it was a, like, not the clearest conversation also not the unclearest as we had further along, but I started to flounder a bit, and then they said, okay, look, come back on Monday with your husband, come together and we'll go from there. So I left and I called him and told him over the phone, and I was just in complete shock and numb. And I'd gone there with my parents. they'd gone off to town, and so I called them. My mum tried to hug me, and I just like put my hands out, and I was like, I can't. And got in the car and just traveled home in silence. And when I got out, I left the car. I had adrenaline. There was adrenaline pumping around my body, and I ran into the house. I went into my bedroom and I started pulling my clothes off. And then my mind caught up and was like, what are you doing? Okay, well, I'll have a shower then. But then Rasmus came in and scooped me up. And then I think I began to cry. And then it was a horrible weekend of trying to process what I had been told, what we could see on the images from the scan. And yeah, I think for Rasmus straight away, it was very clear what the scans showed, and he had more clarity. I still felt like this might resolve. Maybe we'll have a scan on Monday and he'll be moving normally again. My mind was trying to find, you know.
It's not what you want to be hearing. This is not what you've set out for. You've gone into this as in, we are having a baby together. We're starting a family. We're bringing home this is our baby to bring home.
Mm-hmm. And the pregnancy had been so like blissful. I'd had a really fortunate, like no sickness, no nothing. And everything was fine. Everything was fine. And then it was, just breaks your brain.
Did you have a sense of, just listening to you there saying, you know, everything with the pregnancy was good, was fine, and then being told, no, it's not fine, like a sense of, well, I would know if it's not okay.
Yeah, that was part of why I couldn't click while they were getting worried in the scan. And that's something that I've dissected a lot since. And my relationship with my intuition has been one of the biggest parts of the healing process for me. It really shook me to the core. And because, you kind of, I guess I had that impression that you would just know if something's wrong. But at the same time, I can see that Forrest was okay inside of me.
Yeah.
He didn't.
He was safe there.
He was safe. I believe that he wasn't in pain. So partly that. But at the same time, Rasmus actually reminded me afterwards that I was really impatient to feel him move. So, you know, when I think we got to about 18 weeks when I thought, we should start to feel something now, the quickening. Mm. And I was excited for that and didn't really have an experience that convinced me I was feeling it. But when we looked online, it says it's completely normal, especially if you haven't had a full term pregnancy before.
It can take a while to feel that. It could be where the placenta is placed. Yeah. It could be lots of reasons why you might not.
So it's easy enough to tell you, even if you had a doubt, it's so easy to read that and go, okay, don't worry then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why would I want to worry about that?
Yeah. No, but why would you even think? This is the thing. It's like, nobody thinks these things are going to happen to them.
No.
You don't, you know, this is not.
It's not the human. Well, no. Unless you're a very anxious person, I guess some people.
Well, unless you've had it happen to you before, but if it's the sort of first instance of something going wrong in pregnancy, then you just don't think these things are going to happen to
I know
you.
And it's so easy now to look back and think it was naive, but it's not. It's just
not your experience,
where your experience was at the time.
So an anxious weekend, you in a state of, this can't really be happening, and there's a possibility they've got it all wrong. Rasmus seeing and reading what is in front of him, and being preparing himself for the worst, in a sense. And you go back in, and with Rasmus this time, and you go in together.
And I think we did the amnio that day. Beforehand we sat down, they talked through everything again, and let us ask questions. And we didn't really have so much to say, to be honest, and not until after after the amnio. But yeah, just gave Rasmus some clarity around what had been said and what they meant and what were the chances of something changing. And they were very clear, like they didn't expect anything to change. So they did a scan, obviously, for the amnio, and he hadn't moved. Both hands were frozen in this position.
Yeah.
Both legs were completely straight and wouldn't bend. So, they did the amnio, which was a really unpleasant experience.
Mm.
And then we had a lot more questions after that about, when will the results be? What will the results mean? Essentially, with his condition, they give it an umbrella term, which is arthrogryposis. With that, the amnio is not really going to tell you much more.
No, because it sounds like it's a structural thing. Yeah,
exactly. It's a musculoskeletal developmental anomaly. And it's in that way, our situation was more black and white than a lot, because, it wasn't a gray diagnosis. It was very much fact.
Yeah.
This is how he is. And this is going to affect his development from now on. It's already affecting his development because he can't move in the way he should be moving. And it obviously going to greatly affect his life and quality of life. The one thing they weren't clear about is whether he would survive and survive full term and survive birth. They couldn't answer straight.
Yeah. Out. So that's your sort of gray part as far as, is this, I'm going to put it in inverted commas, survivable.
Yeah.
And in what way? Yeah. What does that look like? And that's where they go, we don't know. We can't tell you.
Exactly.
So many parents, me included, having to make these decisions without a full picture. Maybe that's not quite right, but it's kind
you
of
feel like there are, you have questions that no one can answer, and it's the strangest feeling to.
Yeah.
And then they're like still.
And they're like, and what would you like to do?
What's your decision then?
Yeah. And you're going, but you haven't answered my questions to the fullest extent that I would like, because I want you to tell me. Effectively, I can remember thinking, well, basically, I want you to tell me almost what I should do, it kind of in a way. But I want you to tell me that there is no chance, because I don't want to have to make this decision.
Yeah.
I was also told, I think you'll miscarry. And I remember thinking, well, if that's the case, can we just get on with it, please? Because I don't want to have to make this decision.
Mm-hmm. I wished to miscarry.
I think that's a really common thing. Anybody listening to this that has been there and thought that and maybe feel guilty about that, that is a really common thing to go, I just wish I didn't have to make this decision.
Yeah, of course.
It's hard. It makes sense.
It's one of the heaviest burdens that exists for anyone, anywhere.
Yeah.
The decision to end a life.
Yeah.
Extremely heavy.
Extremely heavy, a massive responsibility that needs to be carried for the rest of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, I know your process of, you decided to end the pregnancy, you decided to go for termination, and I know what that process is. You don't need to describe that here if you don't wish to. Rasmus has described that. It's up to you. What do you think, Buff?
I'll keep riffing.
Keep riffing.
Because I'm thinking, already just remembering some other details of how it felt, especially around that, and when the medical staff can't give you clarity. That really clouded my thinking. And it was at that point that a friend of mine put me in touch with a doula in the UK who specializes in loss, been supporting parents who have lost a baby or about to lose a baby. It can be any of the spectrum of ways. But so, I began talking with her, and she held me and guided me through the 2 weeks between the scan and the TFMR. And she helped me a lot with that headspace, because I think it's in the end, basically, there was a lot of external noise. Rasmus had a lot of clarity and kind of knew how he felt and what he wanted. And The medical staff gave some clarity, but also some fogginess. And I'd been put in touch with another obstetrician who's much more alternative, works in a private practice in the city by a friend. So I was talking with her, and then she had another kind of set of recommendations, and I ended up a bit of a whirl and not hearing myself anymore.
Yeah.
So working with her, just some simple practices like journaling things and asking myself a few questions, and some trying to clear my field a little bit to feel, because one of the things I struggled with the most was the decision to have the fetus side injection.
Yeah.
That was really difficult. I just kept thinking, if I could have a chance to meet him, just to look into his eyes. And so my doula recommended that I try to connect with him, with Forrest. She said, see if you can like meditate and just kind of ask him.
Yeah.
What's his journey look like? And I managed to do that. And it was, really clear, really clear. So I meditated. I had, you know, an emotional outpouring, settled into kind of vision that I was going to see him. And yeah, I don't know. It just felt, it landed in my body very clearly that he would not, he was going to go before that. So I chose to have the fetus side injection. And that was the hardest part of all of it for me.
Yeah.
Rasmus was allowed to, throughout, like after we had the first scan, Rasmus was allowed to stay with me. So they were great at like adapting to the circumstances, and they were very supportive and sweet. And yeah, we were taken to a room and I began to cry. It was very like heavy, panicky, anxious, crying, really, really overwhelming. And then they left us alone for quite a while. And again, this, much like the poetry, this was all, I didn't really have a plan. It just happened. The process I went through at this point was spontaneous. And I flipped over into prayer position and I sang. I sang a song that I was singing at bedtime for him. And that helped me to regulate my nervous system. So I managed to sing the song through and gradually calming as I sang. And then we just sat together and I kept sort of reminiscing about different forests that we've spent time in, like jungle in Colombia and this magical magnetic forest in Argentina where I went once. And so they came back and started the procedure. And we know it's a lot like the amnio. So you really have to stay still. And I again meditated and I went inwards and I went to see Forrest. And I won't express it fully, but that was his parting for me. And I shared with Rasmus afterwards what had happened. And he said, oh, that's like a Viking burial, which again, I had no plan, no like predetermined thoughts about it, but of course, with his Danish roots, it made sense. And then it was over. And from then on, and through the process of being induced and going into labor and birthing him, I felt pretty numb, I would say.
Yeah.
Something happened. There was like a protective blanket around me. I felt lucid and, you know, but just I didn't have much emotion, like, really floating through it. Still connected to my body. I listened to my body and followed my instincts with how to move and, you know, when I wanted to shower and things like that, but just didn't feel that much. And I remember after, when it was all over and he'd gone away, I texted my doula and said, and told her as much. Mm. She said, that's pretty normal. And
It sounds like this doula was really important for you, because you had a 2-week space. She helped you to frame that space and do what you needed to do to connect back to what you needed and what was right for you and Forrest.
Mm-hmm. She also opened up the experience, and it was something that I think I was subconsciously craving, needing, that this wasn't pure tragedy.
Yeah.
That there could be more depth to it than that. And
this is still the birth of your son.
Yes. And she made me realize that you're still going to give birth, and you're still going to see your baby if you want to.
Yeah.
And that he was still alive at the point when we met, and he was still with me, and we still had some time together. And that, yeah, those 2 weeks were difficult, but also there were some layers of bliss for me, just really reveling in the time with him, that he was there. He was moving by this point. I could feel occasional movements. So just, yeah, I was very inwards, and all focused on him and singing to him, holding him.
I'm really moved by your description of moving into prayer position and singing to him, singing to yourself.
It's a miracle. I don't know how I could sing or breathe. I just, your whole body reacts to that situation. It's like an animal instinct. Get away from me. Don't hurt my baby.
Yeah.
And yeah, somehow that song just worked, and and it calmed me down. And I was singing to him.
Yes.
I wanted him to feel safe. Because obviously when I'm in that state, he's feeling everything I'm feeling. My nervous system's on panic mode, then he's going to be alarmed. And I needed to shift that energy because I wanted him to feel peaceful.
Yeah. So this whole time I'm hearing you working hard to be a mum to him.
Yeah.
And I think, to the end. Yeah.
And beyond.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if we can maybe talk about the time this year has gone through. Poetry became an outlet. I'm very aware that you're in Portugal. Neither you or Rasmus is Portuguese. Your family is not there. Your close friends presumably are not there. So how did you support yourself, and how did that look?
Yeah, we're fairly isolated even before COVID came along. My parents do live here though. They moved over as well. So I have had my mum and dad close.
Okay.
And another, kind of like with the mentor I had, another strange coincidence was that a neighbor of ours was pregnant at the same time as me and also had a TFMR a couple of weeks before we did.
Wow.
So we connected at the time in between. She was the person that taught me about what the procedure was like. I honestly didn't imagine I'd be given birth. It didn't enter my mind.
Yes, a lot of people are shocked by that. They sort of go, what? Me too. I assumed that I would not be giving birth. I assumed I'd have an operation.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And we weren't offered that, interestingly. I know not everywhere has the choice.
Yeah.
So she was part of helping me prepare, and we were able to talk with each other and understand each other. But as far as like my close friends, we maintain contact on, messaging platforms and video calls.
Yeah.
Actually, I had, again, another spontaneous, unthought through reaction was to reach out. I think the day after the scan, I think I woke up at 4 a.m. or something, and I went to the living room, and I just felt I was full of this restless energy, almost panicky, like I needed to do something. Like if there's any chance of a miracle, if there's any chance of anything changing here to save me from this hell, I need help. So I messaged all of my closest connections and friends and just told them essentially what happened and asked them to please like talk to the trees, send good vibes, do anything like prayer, whatever your thing is. Let's just try it, because I was
the desperation. Yeah.
And that even if, that's pipe dreams, I'll feel you and you'll hold me through this. And I honestly feel that part of it worked. So yeah, I was actually talking to quite a lot of people on my phone, and there's like a community call that I go to sometimes. I share where people share, and I shared at that, and got another sort of outpouring of support and holding. And Rasmus and I talked and held each other. There was like some coming in and out of connection and not. Mostly I felt like we were, by the time he was born, I felt like Rasmus and I were one person. Just felt like such a unifying experience. But I know that, I think I've heard this on one of your other shows with one of the couples. I felt like we were kind of the opposite, in that I was more internal and struggled to express what was happening inside of me and the thoughts and feelings associated with my grief. Whereas he was much more articulate about it.
Did you experience any sort of cultural differences around this? Was there anything like how people responded to you in this, like your neighbors and stuff?
I felt it a bit, also with the hospital staff. I felt it a bit, and yeah, they were very sympathetic, very understanding, but also there was a sense of like, you know, when you're going through this, this is hard, but then it'll be over and then you'll be okay.
Okay.
And yeah, like my neighbors, a lot of my neighbors are old, elderly. And so they've, after a couple of weeks, they're like, you okay now? All better now?
Yeah. Almost like the stiff upper lip sort of thing of like, yeah, it moved on now. And it, I mean, Portugal's a Catholic country. So was there any sort of feeling of, I can't be honest about what this is?
No, not at all. Okay. And I think, although it's Catholic here, I find it's not so pious, and in our experience. And the hospital staff were like, we support your decision, whatever it is. There was never any fear of judgment there. And just the way they presented his case, they were clear that there wasn't a lot of hope, that there was
had a leaning to what was best for you and him, it sounds
I'd
like.
Say, I'd sense that, yeah. They do have this thing. We've been to a funeral. One of our neighbors passed away quite suddenly. And at the funeral, there's a small group of women who cry very loudly, like howling.
About this.
I think they call it keening. And they wave handkerchiefs and they just howl and howl. And our friend explained to us that this is traditional, and that it's to help everyone else get their feelings out, to feel it, to let it surge and all come out right there in the funeral. They also tend to have the funeral the day after. Very fast. And it seems to me, it seems to hold this energy of like, well, we've got to get back to work tomorrow, we've got to get back in the fields, you know. This kind of rural farmer kind of attitude towards it.
Yeah, and I wonder, with things like being part of the rural life, you are part of the cycles. You're very much, you see the life and death happening all around you all the time. What do you think?
I feel, yeah. You know how after a loss like this, a big chunk of the grief is sort of grieving parts of yourself, or the way you felt before, or the way you saw yourself before. And many times I've reflected at how hard I seem now.
Yeah.
Like when we've lost chickens and I've been like, ah, hey ho.
Yeah.
I used to be so sensitive about it. Yeah. And I think it helps in that, for me, it's just, there's an underlying peace with everything I've struggled with through this experience. I haven't struggled with the decision I made. I haven't struggled with the facts of the matter. I've felt peaceful about, you know, I felt like it just took a bit of a shift of perspective, because we have these formed ideas of what constitutes an existence and a life. But if you go from his perspective, and that he existed in this miracle time in the dark, semi-dark inside of me, and then it ended there, like, why can't that also be a life?
And of course it can. You're absolutely right, though. We have this sort of preconceived idea about what counts.
Yeah.
And I remember that was one of the things I really struggled with after Luna was born, was this feeling of like, but does she count? You know, I didn't have the cards coming in and the recognition. And there was a sense of me like, I knew that she counted, but it was also, how do I grasp that? And you're right. It's like a change of perspective, a change of focus, really.
Yeah.
So going back to the sort of writing and the poetry, this ability to kind of let that tap into, key into the shifting of perspective, of being able to look at something, look at what's happened in this other form. And you use nature a lot in that.
Yeah, that's, and now that's forming part of his existence. Mm. So it was that short time, but now he continues to exist in the words and in the relationships and connections that have sprung up since. Mm. And that's always growing. And so his existence, I feel, is just as rich, just as valuable, and it's just different from what we're used to, the way we're used to looking at it, you know, like coming into connection with you and doing this. And I made a really close friend in the UK with their organization is called Forever Young Forest.
Mm-hmm. I know them. Yes.
you know them. So, you know, we found each other and was like, wow. Okay. And I know a lot of parents find that they need to channel somehow, contribute somehow. Like, it was really impactful for me how, if it weren't for certain connections that I had in my life, I would have had no idea what support was out there. I would have had no idea who to turn to or what to do. I don't know how I would have gotten through those 2 weeks in between without my doula. And I don't know how, if I wasn't so fortunate as to have like good friendship connections where I was able to share and express. And it just made me, you know, my already broken heart just broke more thinking of the people that don't know that they can find support, that they can, that there are spaces and places, and a lot of them are free. And so I felt driven, particularly early on, I felt very driven to sharing my poetry, connecting with people. So yeah, I continued to do that. I've been supporting Lucy with Ellie's Gift app as well. So my day job, I work in environmental organizations with like digital strategies and stuff like that. So I wanted to turn it into something valuable for the baby loss community.
And it's also for legacy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And the retreat.
And the retreat that you're building. It's
literally there. Our little forest.
Yeah.
And this place where, because when I heal a little from this schism with nature, I began eventually to get back into the garden, and then it became quite a therapy again. And I was taking care of the garden, planting foods and growing stuff. And of course, when you're doing that with him in mind, when it felt like taking the nurturing I needed to give to him and giving it to the plants and the trees and the things here, then again, it just felt like infusing this place with his existence. And so now it's this has come in and out again with this healing of my relationship with my intuition. And what do I trust my beliefs and my feelings when they haven't always showed up when I need them? Yeah. The last week on the anniversary of his birth, I felt a big healing with that aspect. I do. Sometimes I do feel him in this place. Like some moments, it's not like every butterfly, oh, that's for it. No, it's just when there's that pang, that, then okay, take it. Like,
No, they're really important parts to our grief and our healing, and that sort of moving with it, really.
Yeah, movement. It's a famous line for managing grief is movement is.
Yeah. I mean, everything that you're describing, it's interesting because listening to Rasmus speak, he had very little. It was very much coming from him and then you and him. You know, that was his main support. And I think, you know, it's just you were able to access more in comparison.
Yeah. I called more in, but I think you'll probably find this similar, that unless somebody's also lost a baby,
yeah,
nobody's really able to support you or hold that space.
Yeah.
And it's hard to put it on other people. Like, I struggled to share with some of my closer friends, but I could share with a stranger because I knew that they'd had a similar experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, I think I socialized a lot, as in through messaging and group video calls and things, but it was not around me being supported. It was just spending time together and talking about other stuff, other life stuff. But when it came to dealing with my emotions and my processing my grief and learning to live as a mother without her son, that was very internal. And again, this is where a lot of the poetry came from, and a lot of time spent by myself. Here we have a couple of cabins for our retreat. I spent a lot of time in one of the cabins, just being with myself and how I felt. And like, apart from that initial urge to share and talk about it, that dissipated. And I'd say the last sort of 7 months or so, I've been much more internal, and it's been harder to share and articulate, and almost in a protective way, like keeping it for myself. And
I'm quite protective in that way. I mean, I haven't. So one of my ways is I haven't shared any photos of Luna on social media. And that's just a choice that I've made. I don't have very many photos of Luna. That's a sort of a regret, you know, that I don't have more. And so what I do have, they're mine.
Precious.
Yeah, they're precious. And it's not that, of course, I know that people would be very sort of supportive and would be kind and would, you know, in this community, that would be the messages that I would get. But there is something for me about having her just, I don't know, that I get that. There's this sort of protective bit, even though I know that she would be safe in this community. It's just something wanting to keep a bit for me, her for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that, you know, we've touched on your eco retreat, and what I'm going to do is put into the notes a bit more about that for people, because you guys are building in some work for people who've gone through grief and baby loss, which I think is fantastic. So we will talk a bit more about that in the notes, perhaps.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. We can even do it in the future.
Like, exactly. Yes.
We're closing down now because Rose is on the way. So it's going to be a bit more in the future. And I do want to give some thought to, like, maybe a more structured offering.
Yeah. Well, how about, because you've brought Rosa in here, I wondered if you just wanted to say a little bit of something about Rosa and
Yeah. So we're expecting Forrest's sister to join us in May. And Rosa began to exist, I think it was 7 months after. I know I wanted to try to conceive immediately. That was my first instinct.
Yeah.
But when I got my first period, I was relieved. And then I realized, no, I need this time, just me and my son forming our new relationship now, you know. And so I think it was after the due date had passed, I started to think about it again. And then a couple months later, we conceived. And that was really, that was quite a tough moment for me, actually. And that was maybe one of the lowest points in the last year for my mental health. It was a lot. It was just a lot. And I think at that point, I wasn't talking to anyone either. I didn't have any specific sort of therapeutic support. Yeah, I was also struggling with COVID, with whether to get the vaccine, this stuff, you know, and now I'm pregnant and it was just a lot. And my hormones were absolutely off the charts.
And you're still grieving
Yeah. And that grief shifts and warps quite a bit when there's another child comes into the picture, because then it's like, yeah, mostly my confused thoughts were around if he'd been born, she'd never have been conceived, and you know, and this kind of dynamic, and that fucked with me a bit. That took a bit of processing. Anyway, 8 months later, it's all going very well. It's been hard, but not terrible, and has been healing as well. Mm. And what I'm really taking forward with me now is that I'm quite excited because she's his sister and their relationship is very much alive and is going to just keep growing. And that just makes my heart burst. we're in the home stretch now.
We were the urgency of getting you and Rasmus recorded because I knew that once Rosa makes her entrance onto the stage, that you will be quite busy, and rightly so. You will not be wanting to come and sit on a podcast and talk to me. So I was like, let's get you in as soon as possible.
I'm glad we could do this.
Yeah, me too. So how about on that note, it feels quite a good poem to be reading now, which is called Joy After Loss.
Yeah. Joy just might be the single most difficult emotion for me to feel recently, because with joy comes pain. Every happiness, every smile, every laugh and cheer is followed by me wishing you were here. Love overcomes me frequently. I struggle to breathe, see, or smell. Clouded senses have a lot to tell. How can I feel so numb whilst feeling so much? This pain is difficult to soothe with touch. I feel trapped all alone with it, even though I'm not. Recently, the days are so hot. We've been staying inside a lot. But back to the joy, this sparkly new toy. I've never felt happiness as intense as this. Those two red lines, imagining the eyes you were growing inside, your tiny fist bumps made my heart soar and jump. A happiness as real as this, our first and last kiss. It started with you, my sweet darling boy, born to adagio for strings, born upon angel's wings. I opened myself up to this exquisite pain, because pain is a parent's domain, and you are at peace, soaring high with the geese, in the whisper of leaves and the bark of the trees. In the Garden of Eve, where the river runs deep to the edge of the sea, where you rested in me, and I still feel your cells. As my body repels almost anything that isn't just what it needs. Yes, I'm meeting my needs, sitting still, planting seeds in the Garden of Eve and our shared joy. Oh, perfect baby boy. Is my strength and deed.
Thank you, Buff. I feel very, very honored. Yeah. Thank you so much for reading for us.
You're most welcome. It brings me joy to share his spirit and
yeah. And we will continue this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I know we will.
Yeah. Yeah, we should.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. It'd be really nice to hear about your creativity. You know, have you used creativity to help you process your grief, your trauma? I think it's a really powerful tool. So it'd be really lovely to hear about that from you. Get in touch. We love hearing from you. Find us over on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Time to Talk TFMR and Twitter at Talk TFMR. So that's all for this time. Thank you, and please take gentle care of yourselves.